This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. If you've never heard of Thomas Francis Marr, stay with us. You'll want to learn about this extraordinary man who left his mark on Ireland, Australia, and the United States. Born to a wealthy family, he led a revolt against the British during the Great Famine in Ireland in the 1840s. Marr was arrested, sentenced to death, and then sent to a penal colony in Tasmania. He escaped and arrived in America, where he later led an Irish brigade, the Fighting 69th, during the Civil War. They fought at Antietam, Bull Run, and Fredericksburg, among the bloodiest battles in that war. Marr then became territorial governor of Montana, where he took on violent vigilantes and died under mysterious circumstances. Our guest, Timothy Egan, has brought Thomas Francis Marr to life in his new book. It's called The Immortal Irishman, The Irish Revolutionary Who Became an American Hero. Timothy Egan is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. He's a New York Times op-ed columnist and joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. And, Tim, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. And what a terrific story.
And it's great to be with you on this extraordinary spring day.
Indeed it is. You know, as I was reading the book, I kept thinking, why don't I or we know more about Thomas Francis Marr? We know about Lafayette. We know about other people, other foreigners who came to this country and changed this country. Mm-hmm. But we don't know as much about
Marr. I think part of it is Marr at one point was easily the most famous Irish American. I mean, they called him a savior. They predicted he was going to be the one who was going to help the poor Irish masses living in tenements in Philadelphia and New York and Boston to come out of these horrible, horrible circumstances they were living in when they landed here. And then, of course, the Irish Brigade made him a household word. So he was very good friend with Abraham Lincoln. I mean, and the first Irishman ever appointed as a general. He was named a political general. So, and there were Marr clubs all over America. They had, it was a Marr polka. You could do a dance.
Marr polka?
Yeah. And so his dad, when he came to visit him, was a little appalled by how famous he was. He would draw 5,000-10,000 people in every speech. And then he sort of disappears into the mists of American time. How does that happen? I think there's two things that happened. Was the Civil War battles so crushed him and the Irish Brigade. The casualty rate was so awful. And they had hoped that they would be able to take this brigade and go across the pond and liberate their homeland from England. And it didn't do that. And then the draft riots happened, which made the Irish, you know, there was huge riots, nearly burned down New York City over the drafting. And it was really a bloody end. Marr was against that, and he sort of fell out of favor with his Irish, fellow Irish. And then his ending in Montana.
Yeah.
You know, it was not just distant Montana territory. It took, you know, 9 months to get there. So he essentially fell off, literally, actually did fall off the map, fell off a boat possibly. So that's what happened. I think, you know, you can go to Ireland or go to any place in Montana, and he's certainly a household word. But my effort here, Marty, is to try to revive this extraordinary life, because I think you see the whole Irish-American experience in this one short life. A dozen lives lived in one life.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. He's born in 1823, a pretty wealthy family, a life of privilege. One of the people that knew him said, this lad could talk.
Right.
He knew five languages. And one could imagine a life of privilege. He could have been a merchant or just sort of lived in the lap of luxury, but not him.
Right. And he was you have to set the context. He was a rare person of privilege in a country where about 80% of the people were dispossessed. I mean, it was a crime for a long time to speak your native language. It was a crime to own property. It was a crime to practice your faith, Roman Catholicism. It's a crime to play your sport of hurling. They arrested people who played the harp. Queen Elizabeth outlawed the Irish instrument. So they'd done all these things to deculture these people, sort of a template for apartheid, essentially. And Marr was the rare exception, because his family had gone to Newfoundland, which was the first English colony. And you know what the Irish did the minute they arrived in Newfoundland? They established a hurling club.
Of course.
Because their sport had been outlawed by the Brits. And when the father comes back, the grandfather actually, he is a man of wealth, a merchant. And Marr is this good-looking young lad with this superb education. He went to this Downton Abbey-style heap in England and could have had just nothing but a life of leisure ahead of him. But he always was sort of a rebellious spirit, and he's found the life fake. You know, he's called it imitations of English life, these phony aristocrats. And what radicalizes him, literally as he comes of age, when he's done with his schooling and arrives and his father says, you can take over the business, and he doesn't want any of that. He goes to Dublin, falls in with this group of intellectuals and poets, and they were all lovers and writers. They were young people in their 20s.
Sure.
And full of hope that somehow they could free Ireland, you know, because it was totally under English domination. And the famine happens. And that's what radicalizes him.
Well, you say some really fascinating and frankly really disturbing things about the famine. First, just when we think of it as the potato famine, and many people died, some starved to death, many people left Ireland because of that. But you're saying it's much more complicated than that, and implicates the British.
Right. And that's the conventional wisdom view right now, pretty much. The British didn't start the famine. Let's be clear on that. But after it had gotten underway, they certainly didn't prevent the masses from dying. Well, they made a half-ass effort in a couple ways with these soup kitchens, which, you know, in some cases you had to give up your religion to go. That's why to this day the Irish will say you took the soup.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it means you gave up your – you swapped your faith out to have a 600 calories of warm broth. But let's just back up for a moment. A famine, as it's known in Ireland, the Great Hunger, is the signal event in Irish history, in the same way the Holocaust is for Jews. 1 million Irish died in 4 years' time. 1 million people died. So you had a population of 8. 1 in 8. Imagine in this country if 1 in 8 died next door to the wealthiest empire in the world. Okay? The British Empire was at the peak of its power. The Union Jack flew over 1 out of every 4 acres in the globe. And they were incredibly prosperous at the peak of the early Industrial Revolution. The potato certainly caused it at start because they were peasant class living off the land. An Irish family of 4 could live for a year on an acre of potatoes. And these spores came over possibly in the boats.
A fungus, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so they would go to dig up their crop in the late summer, and the thing would just fall through their hands. It was a humid, fetid mass of black. So they're starving because the potato's gone. But at the same time, and this is the central point, that these people were dying. Food was being exported at an extraordinary rate. Cereal, barley, beef, pork, grains, things, food grown by Irish hands but not put into Irish mouths. So Marr says, let's close the ports. And his fellow Young Ireland rebels, they said, let's not let this food go from here. And one more point, if I could, on the famine. The documents that did come out say, well, the British governor said, what we're doing here is a policy, quote, of extermination. Now, he was warning the prime minister that there's going to be a revolution. He didn't say, you know, let's continue with the extermination. He said, this is a de facto policy of extermination. And in 1997, the epilogue is Prime Minister Tony Blair apologized on the 150th anniversary, and he called it one of the great crimes of England. And that opened the door to all the recent scholarship that's come out in the last 20 years.
Should we think of this as a genocide, the way we think of genocide?
You know,
and why? I mean, if food was being exported out of Ireland, what was the policy? What was the point of that export?
I'll tell you what the people in charge said, and your listeners are smart enough to judge for themselves. Genocide wasn't a term that was known to people back then, but modern scholars often use that term now. Why? Because as it was happening, the British authorities were passing notes back and forth, and they were saying things like, we know these people have bred too fast. We know the population is too big. We know they call them surplus Irish. And one of the rebels wrote a letter, open letter, said, dear fellow surplus brother, you know, how are you among your surplus mates right now? That was one of the rallying cries. We're surplus. And the man in charge of alleviating the famine for England was a man, Lord Trevelyan. He was knighted for this work. And he called this was his word again, the cure. He said it was a cure from the hand of God. He said, this is almighty providence applying the cure to the problem being too many people, that they'd bred too fast, their families were too big, and this was the Lord's cure. There's a picture of Lord Trevelyan hanging in Quinnipiac University's Great Hunger Museum. Beneath that portrait, it says, wanted for crimes against humanity.
Wow.
So that's how the Irish feel about the man who was in charge of alleviating their fate. So I'll just tell you what they said, and people can draw their own conclusions.
Well, Marr and his fellow rebels, revolutionaries, decide to try to organize and prevent the ravages of this famine. But interestingly, I mean, they were interested in poets.
Right.
Was it the idea that we can use language and literature to try to change this policy?
It's like one of the great quixotic crusades of youth and your belief that poems, you know, sonnets against swords. I mean, they really were. That one of the rebels was a woman. They believed in equality for women, which they were well ahead of their time. Her name is Speranza, was her nom de plume. She was the mother of Oscar Wilde, by the way.
Interesting.
But she was one of Marr's lovers. She wrote these powerful poems, 1 million people dead, don't let the food lead the poor. They were just powerful. She was known as the poet of sedition. And Mar was one of her lovers, by most indications. And they really did think that their words – Mar was the greatest orator of his day. And even up to his death, his enemy said, "I never had a better conversation than sitting with Thomas Mar for an hour." He was a brilliant master of words. And that's why he held people spellbound when we get to the Civil War part.
Sure.
But during the Revolution, it was just an uprising. And their idea was that we would move these starving masses. At one point, Mar speaks to 50,000 people. But they were all starving. So I have a chapter called Pitchfork Paddies. And they were just scarecrow Irish. That was another term used. And some of them,
because they were so skinny.
Exactly. And they would. There were all these descriptions of mothers dying in a ditch holding their children. And then they take these poor dead children with their bloated faces, and their teeth were stained green because they'd been gnawing on nettles all day. It was an absolute – I mean, you can read all the accounts, which are just horrifying, by Quakers from England who said, "Why are we letting this happen?" The Choctaw Indian Nation sent a ship of corn to the Irish, and the Brits initially wouldn't let it land in Dublin Harbor. So he tries to get these people to rebel, and they have no guns. You know, they're pitchforks, and it's an absolute failure. And so they're all arrested. These seven leaders of Young Ireland are arrested, and Mar's sentence is to be hanged, drawn, and quartered, and his remains disposed of as Her Majesty shall see fit. Her Majesty is Queen Victoria.
Even though he never fired a shot. I mean, never. He personally never killed anybody.
Thank you for pointing that out. He never fired a shot. He never issued a call to attack. He just said, "It's time for us to rise up and throw off the British yoke so we can feed the people. Or at the very least, stop these ships of food, these exports, from leading the ports and give them to the starving people." There had been food riots. So he went around to these parishes, and they never did. And so he's sentenced to be hanged, drawn, and quartered just for his words, his speeches alone.
Well, we're almost having our first break here, but obviously he didn't die because he goes on to live.
He has four more episodes,
yes,
right.
Multiple lives right here. So was his sentence stayed? What?
Well, there was a global outcry by the American Irish, who were then starting to build their base here. American president even leaned on him, the French, Spanish. And so Queen Victoria, Her Gracious Majesty, was about Mar's age, commuted the sentence. Good news, you're no longer to be hanged, drawn, and quartered. Bad news, he'll never see Ireland again. Mm-hmm. He's sentenced to spend the rest of his life at the age of 25 on the god-awful island of Tasmania. Now, remember, the Brits were trying to make a penal colony of a continent. Tasmania was a special place in that hell. That's where they sent their most intelligent, witty – that's where they sent the political prisoners.
Well, as you say, 40,000 Irish go to Tasmania. 25% of them are women. I was really surprised to read that. And about 1% were political prisoners.
Exactly. Exactly. So one in four of the original people sent to the penal colony, which is – again, it just knocked me on my – it's just so extraordinary. This idea that you're going to take a whole continent and make it into essentially an open-air penitentiary. Oh, they thought it was a solution to, you know, petty crime. And most of the people were stealing bread or shoes or something like that. It was really, they're really petty crimes.
Thus was created Australia,
right? Exactly.
That's Timothy Egan, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about Thomas Francis Mar. That's the subject of his new book. It's called The Immortal Irishman, The Irish Revolutionary Who Became an American Hero. Timothy Egan writes for the New York Times. He's a op-ed columnist for the Times, and we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation about Thomas Francis Mar. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Timothy Egan about Thomas Francis Mar, the subject of Egan's new book. And again, it's called The Immortal Irishman, The Irish Revolutionary Who Became an American Hero. And we are getting a snapshot of his very complicated and amazing life. And if you want to join the conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So Mar ends up at this penal colony in Tasmania, along with thousands of other Irish men and women. Mm-hmm. So what is life like on this penal colony?
Well, it's a very strange thing. This is the Victorian age. So the political prisoners, if they gave a pledge to not escape, they were not put in a cell and they were not lashed with the cat o' nine tails, which is what they did to the common criminals. They had a little district where you lived the rest of your life, 7 miles by 7 miles. You were never supposed to leave your district, but Mar always found ways to sneak over the bridge to have lunch with his buddies and this and that. And they were – again, think of these people in their 20s, and they're all brilliant, and they're all of them that go on to brilliance later. It's amazing things in their lives. And they're in this godforsaken place. I mean, actually, Tasmania is quite beautiful, but then it was called that isthmus between hell and earth,
whoa,
you know, and because it was an active penal colony. They've got road crews where they're whipping him and all this stuff. And he's really lonely. This is the most
He's a young man,
yeah,
right?
He's the most gifted orator of his age, and he's talking to his dog. You know, he takes these long walks in the jungles of Tasmania, and all he does is – and he just laments that, I'll never get my chance. He writes these letters. I want to make a dent in history. I want to have something. I want to have – I don't want my life to pass through without having done something. And here I am in this 14,000 miles. It took 9 months to get there. It really is the end of the earth. It's like you or I going to Mars on a penal colony.
But he does escape.
He escapes. And that's, I think, one of the most gripping sections of his life is that it's a 12-day escape, and it's pretty extraordinary. He escapes, and then he comes to New York City in 1852, and they hear of his escape. And the Irish-American newspapers are saying, all praise to Thomas Mar. He's coming to America. I mean, so now his status, he's gone from the orator who defied them during the Revolution to this man who actually escaped the penal colony. So he's coming to America, and they say this is the – at the same time that 1.5 million Irish are washing ashore, and literally they're washing ashore. They've never been outside of their villages, and we've got this great surge of immigration we're seeing for the first time in our history. And Mar's destiny is hung on him. He will be the man to unite and guide him, and he doesn't have any idea what that will be.
And this is 1852 when he comes to New York.
Yes.
He is an escaped convict, so it's not like he's a legal immigrant.
He's not in any way. He's a criminal. They send their worst people. You know, he's not, as Donald Trump said, a rapist, but he is a criminal. So so are many of the other Irish, I mean, that are coming ashore. There are people in really bad circumstances who've come, and they're bringing disease. There's this typhus on the ships. They call them coffin ships. So they're wretched masses. They really are. And they're living in tenements. Yeah. Some of them are doing well. Here in Philadelphia, they have established neighborhoods. But you're also starting to see some pushback at the same time he arrives, too.
Well, there is this party, the Know Nothing Party, that what gets organized because they oppose immigration. Does it have the familiar ring? I don't know.
I like to say that the vapors of history are moving through this presidential campaign right now because just consider this. So we're a nation of immigrants. Everyone here is from somewhere else except for your Native American, which is only 1% of the population. But the first real wave of people who were others were Irish. They were followed by Germans, Eastern European Jews, Italian Americans, people from the Asians, all over the world, of course. But the Irish were the first ones to feel the brunt of what Mexicans are feeling now. And all the things that anti-immigrant people say about Mexicans now, they're criminals, they're rapists, we know our culture is getting polluted. You could just drop the word Mexican and put in the word Irish and, you know, call them scum. Here in Philadelphia, they burned down the churches. They had what the Jews call pogroms. They burned down an Irish-American firehouse. They had riots. There was just, you know, huge death. This is the peak of the Know-Nothing. At one point, the Know-Nothing Party is the second biggest party in America.
Right.
And they're running a presidential candidate. They have governorships up and down the Eastern Seaboard. And this is what's amazing about time traveling in our history, Marty. It's the only party, major party in our history that's founded for a single purpose, anti-Irish. Specifically, it's not anti-immigration so much as it's anti-Irish.
So what did they think of Thomas Francis
So
Marr,
they
then?
Tried
this,
to
this
knock him down.
Hero,
I mean, here's this guy where they're doing these Mar polkas and these Mar clubs are springing up and he's speaking to 5,000-10,000 people. He's quickly becoming, he quickly does become, let me rephrase it, the best known Irish American. He's giving speeches all up and down and he pushes back on the Know-Nothings. Here's the problem. He's looking for a way, as is everyone, that the Irish can become American. I mean, they are clustered in these tenements. They are clannish. A lot of them speak Gaelic. The New York Times writes about them in the tenements, and he says, this was a place, this is a quote, where the pigs and the paddies lie down together at night, you know, as if they had, because some of them slept with their pigs. You know, they were rural people, and so the right-thinking people, the WASP of the world, look at them and say, my God, what are they doing here?
Right.
So Mar's thing is, how can we make them belong? How can they become American? That arrives in the form of the Civil War.
Well, that's so interesting because he does head up this brigade, the Fighting 69th.
The Fighting 69th, which people know very well in this part of the country. I'm from the West, so was formed out of the New York militia, mostly an Irish militia, but out of that became the actual formal Irish Brigade. And at the outbreak of the Civil War, there's a real question of which way the Irish would go. Because Frederick Douglass tours Ireland in the famine, and he's amazed, the ex-slave, orator, newspaper man. He says, I find myself treated as a man and not as a color. He was impressed that they didn't see any racism. But he also was appalled by the state of the peasantry. He says, only the American slaves have it worse than the poor Irish. Then he notes 10 years later that when the Irish come to America, they start to pick up some racial attitudes that they didn't have when they were there. And it's because they're being told that if these 4 million slaves – remember, Marty, we are the biggest slaveholding nation on earth at that time, 4 million slaves. And they're being told if they're free, they'll take your crappy jobs.
Yeah.
So they're building the sewers here. They're running the rail lines. They're building the canals in upstate New York. They're domestics taking care of other people's children. They're shoveling crap into the river. Those are terrible jobs, but they at least are jobs. And they're told these slaves will take them.
Well, he becomes what, a recruiter for
huge
the,
recruiter. So
for the
and
union.
It costs him a lot of his loyalty in, among fellow Irish. Abraham Lincoln brilliantly names him a general. This is a person with no military experience. Mm-hmm. Names him a general in this, to heading up the Irish Brigade, and they then go off and fight. Some of the most iconic battles in the Civil War, starting with Bull Run, where the Union was routed, but the Irish didn't run. So the cover of my book is a picture of Marr returning triumphantly after the Battle of Bull Run. And that's, to answer your earlier question, that's what starts to allow the Irish to become Americans by their sacrifice itself. And this is Marr's recruiting. He says, you know, this blood sacrifice, and he sticks it to the know-nothings. He gives speeches in Boston. He says, look how many people are dying in the Irish Brigade. Don't tell me we're not Americans.
Well, here's one of the posters that's hung up, Young Irishmen to Arms, To Arms Young Irishmen. Irish Zouaves?
Mm-hmm, Zouaves, right.
I don't know what that means.
That was a little unit, subunit within the unit, yeah.
100 young Irishmen, healthy, intelligent, and active, wanted to at once to form a company under the command of Thomas Francis Marr.
Right.
His idea of thinking that if we fight for the Union, we will be accepted in this country.
Exactly. And you notice he said they wanted intelligent fighters as well, not just people with a pulse. What's interesting about that is that people, you know, the stereotype of the day was that they were drunks, that they drew them as monkeys. I mean, they had big brows and tails in some cases, and that they couldn't organize a parade without fisticuffs, let alone a brigade. So Marr wants to show them that they can. And in fact, as I said, in the first run, the first big battle at Bull Run, they were extraordinary for their warrior. They just didn't run. They fought very hard. And his idea, again, is that this blood sacrifice. So they then go on to fight in some of the bloodiest battles of the Civil War. Antietam, as you know, 23,000 casualties on a single day.
Which is, I don't think we've ever had.
No. And if you extrapolated that out to our present population, we would probably lose 1 million people on a single day or something close to that. So, and the worst for the Irish Brigade, this is what John F. Kennedy summoned from memory when he went and visited Ireland just before he was assassinated in 1963, is the Battle of Fredericksburg, which happened just before the Emancipation Proclamation. Marr tells his people to put a little sprig of green in their caps. He knows they're going to get slaughtered. And he says, at least when we die, when they pull over these bodies, they'll know we died as Irishmen. And they just get mowed down. And they just get just wave after wave if they try to take this hill. Robert E. Lee is on the other side of the hill, and he says, it is well that war is so awful, otherwise we would like it too much because they're just mowing down the waves. And though it does accomplish what Marr wanted to do, which is to show the rest of the nation, Courier and Ives does a big print showing the brigade. I mean, they are becoming heroes now. The brigade is well known as this fighting unit, and eventually 160,000 Irish would fight, and only two brigades at a higher casualty rate than the Irish. It does do that. So he does accomplish this thing through their sacrifice of helping to free the slaves, essentially. And Lincoln knows that that's what the sacrifice is for, but Marr is destroyed by it.
Well, and one can imagine, yes, fighting for a cause. Let's say your husband or your son goes off to fight, but if they become part of this huge amount of casualties, it has a personal impact, right? What did we sacrifice for?
Well, and that's what led to the famous New York draft riots. The Irish were being disproportionately drafted to fight what was still not a winning cause. They were losing most of the battles. And also, you could buy your way out of the draft for $200, or you could bring a body, someone else. So the rich were not being drafted, right. But disproportionately the immigrants were. And so that's what leads to the draft riots. They actually go after Marr, fellow Irish go after him because he's a Civil War recruiter, and this cause is going south. Marr comes to realize, Marnie, that they didn't die for Irish nationalism, which he thought they eventually would. They would go again back across the Atlantic. They died to free the slaves. He incorporates that into his speeches. It doesn't always work, but he comes to see their sacrifice, and for the rest of his life, he will say, you know, we proved ourselves to be Americans, but we also proved ourselves to be liberators.
We are talking about Thomas Francis Marr, which is spelled M-E-A-G-H-E-R. And our guest is Timothy Egan. He's written a book about Marr, and it's titled The Immortal Irishman, The Irish Revolutionary Who Became an American Hero, walking a bit through his life, the various chapters in his life. And again, if you want to join the conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Why did Lincoln, though, name him a general? I mean, highly unusual. He didn't have a military background. What was it that Lincoln saw in Marr?
Yeah, that's why it was brilliant, because the regular army officers did not approve of what were called the political officers. So Lincoln named a number of political officers. He would give them this rank. And the brilliance of it, because it happened right after the war broke out, and it was still thought to be a short – it was going to be a year-long thing at the most, and he didn't know how many troops he'd need. But it was brilliant because, as I said, they didn't know which way the Irish would go. Yeah. And by naming the most prominent Irish-American of the day as the leader of his own brigade, that was a source of pride. And they really – I mean, they carried these little – they're called carte de vistas, which are a little kind of a postcard picture of Marr. And you find it – you found it in so many of their pockets. They went around like we carry a baseball card. Well, I did when I was a kid. I don't now, of course. But, you know, they carried on these little pocket pictures of Marr. And so it brilliantly made him the image of, you know, there with his general's sash and uniform, which I have a picture of on the back. It's it gave them a real source of pride. They weren't suddenly these monkeys, these dirty drunks, these tenement dwellers. There was an officer. There was the highest rank. And Lincoln really liked Marr. He said that Marr was one of the few people who could make him laugh during this grim period. Marr was a great gift of gab, and he could make almost anyone laugh. Probably not Dick Cheney if he was around today, but he made Lincoln laugh. When Lincoln was sick, in the period when he gave the Gettysburg Address, he didn't see anyone on his calendar. This was one of the interesting little side things I found. He didn't see anybody for a week, but he saw Marr. He allowed him in the White House, and they chatted. And, you know, so the sacrifices were truly, truly awful. I mean, this is an industrial-level war.
Well, yes, a war sort of fought with old-fashioned tactics, but modern
weaponry.
So that
very well said. That's exactly right. Old-fashioned tactics. You know, just marching up masses of human beings and having them get mowed down.
Was Marr himself ever injured? I mean, he lost so many men in these various battles.
That's a great question. He lost people that he personally had recruited. And this is why it broke his heart. I have a scene after the Battle of Fredericksburg, the battle I mentioned where they put the green sprigs under their caps and the way they were mowed down. And he's crying. He's going all over the battlefield, and he's turning over the bodies to see if they're Irish, to see with the green. And it's just, and the Confederates have allowed this little period where they can come reclaim their bodies. Mm-hmm. And it just destroys him. The witnesses say he just is – because he's seeing people that he personally recruited. He knows their mothers. He knows their wives. He's going to go face those mothers and face those wives. He has a big pitch in New York City. At the height of the Civil War, he says, follow me. Right. Come with me. I think you read it. Follow me. Come with me. So he's personally responsible for so many of these people. And it does just break his heart.
It is so interesting. Obviously, he was making an argument that not only will we be accepted in this country, the United States, perhaps we can go back and help our countrymen in Ireland, but for those people that were fighting, I mean, you're fighting for a country that didn't really want you, you know, that objected to your entrance into the U.S.
Believe me, the South not only knew that, but the Confederates used that. That was a direct recruitment speech at the Irish. They dropped flyers into Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, all the big four enclaves, saying, this country doesn't want you. Why the hell should you fight for them? And in fact, 70,000 or so Irish did fight for the Confederacy. One of the interesting side notes is that, so there were these seven young Ireland leaders who originally went to Tasmania. One of them was named John Mitchell. That was one of Marr's closest buddies. He was a polemicist while Marr was the orator. Mitchell becomes a fan of slavery when he comes here. And when that aforementioned Battle of Fredericksburg is happening, on the other side of that wall is one and maybe two of Mitchell's children firing down on the Irish from the Confederate side of the wall. So that's a great point you make, that they said to them, this country doesn't want you. Fight on our side. But Mars, just one of the great recruitment pitches he had, was not just that this will make us American, but the Confederates are closer to England. They were trying to get England to recognize them. And England made a lot of money. Remember, their Industrial Revolution, their cotton, all the, you know, weaving and looms and stuff were going, were all built on the back of American slaves. And, you know, cotton was the absolute, you know, money exportation crop of the United States. So Marr would say, look, you know, we hate England more than anything else. The English are cozying up to the Confederates. They buy their cotton, this and that. And there was, for a long time, it was thought that England would recognize the Confederate States. So he used that to counter what you said, is they didn't want them.
We're almost up on our second break here, but did Marr make the argument that, like, you know, we lived like slaves in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're slaves in this country. We can liberate them.
He did later on. That's what he did. He started out. It's one of the interesting arcs of his life. He started out as an agnostic on slavery. And, you know, he said, I was treated well in the South. He did his speaking tour in Charleston and said, boy, they, you know, the squires would take him around. And he said, I don't know what the problem is. These people treat me really, I'm Irish. I found myself treated really well. So he started out making that agnostic argument that, look, it's legal. We can't do anything about it. Why should we fight over it? But the minute the Civil War happens in Fort Sumter, when the South starts it by bombing Fort Sumter, it changes him.
Timothy Egan, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We are talking about Thomas Francis Marr, the subject of Timothy Egan's new book. It's a biography entitled The Immortal Irishman, the Irish Revolutionary Who Became an American Hero. And Timothy Egan won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting. He's an op-ed columnist for the New York Times, won a National Book Award, also winner of the Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Nonfiction. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Timothy Egan about his new book about Thomas Francis Marr, and it's titled The Immortal Irishman. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Tim, you talked about the fact that after the Civil War, perhaps as he lost so many men during the Civil War, it really pained him, I guess, and hurt him. Did he sort of escape to Montana?
Yeah, he gave up his commission to be a general. He said he just could no longer do it. He couldn't face those widows and those wives and those loved ones, and it was a mess. And he just couldn't do it. It broke his heart, like I said. He goes to Tennessee for his last act as a Union officer, and he ends up speaking and doing a few things here and there. He has a small provisional group, but he just couldn't do it. So now he's going to live the last arc of his life, which is sort of a fulfillment of what he thought when he came to New York City. He said, maybe there's a place in the great expanse of America where these teeming masses can escape these terrible tenements. Again, I can't stress enough, you'd have families of 10 living in 100 square foot. There's a great museum in New York called the New York City Tenement Museum where you can get a sense of what it was like, straw on the floor or a little bucket for the latrine. It was just awful. And he sees in Montana something that the American ambassador to Ireland had suggested they call New Ireland, which I'd never heard before.
Yeah,
I don't know if you had.
No, I hadn't.
I mean, we have a New Jersey, a New England, but this is going to be New Ireland. And he said, the American ambassador wrote the president, and he said, this is when Lincoln was still in office, and before he was assassinated, he said, why don't we appoint General Marr as the territorial secretary and rename this big, giant territory. I mean, Montana was 10 times the size of – it then included Idaho. It was 10 times the size of Ireland as New Ireland. Yeah. So Marr sees a chance to live under the clear skies of Montana – and start anew with his fellow Irish.
And he's what, the territorial governor?
Yeah, it's a funny story. So he's the number two guy there. He's the secretary. And he didn't know any of this. How could you? Because communication took forever back and forth by boats. And there was just a really long way to reach. It took 6 months to get there.
Wow.
He arrives. And waiting for him in this godforsaken town of Virginia City, which is like this HBO series Deadwood, you know, people hanging from the rope on one side.
I can see it.
You know,
I can smell
drunks
it.
Drunks rolling down there. Yeah, poop everywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. It was really your prototypical, just awful. This is the territorial capital, with brothels everywhere. And this, that. Marr arrives. And the minute he arrives, this well-dressed gentleman with his hat and his two daughters and his wife comes out and hands him a sheath of papers and says, you, sir, are now the governor. I am out of here. And he gets on the stage that brought Marr to Virginia City and is never seen again. So now Marr is the territory, this convict, this fugitive of the British Empire, this man with a price on his head, is now the territorial governor of the biggest territory in the United States and will be for the next 2 years.
Well, he does manage to marry someone. It seemed like they really had quite a love affair. And you do have a photograph of the of what, the governor's mansion?
Yeah, much of my friends have said, I visited the cabin where he lived, which they jokingly called the governor's mansion. You know, it's a little log hut with, you know, it's like 100 square feet. It's really awful. It smells. And you know, tiny little window, drafty, all this stuff. And you know, Virginia City is 6,000 feet above sea level, so it's really cold. Snows 9 months of the year. And my friend said, boy, she must have really loved him.
Did she really love him?
Well, that's what's great about it. I like to think there's a love story here because he did fall in love with the love of his life in a woman who was everything he was not. She was from the Townsend family, the Sterling Ironworks, which had, you know, was one of the wealthiest families in America. She was a WASP. He was a Catholic. He was a Celt. She was Anglo-Saxon. She was this Fifth Avenue beauty of this huge American family. And she gave up everything to follow this rebel. And they were this close. She nursed his wounds at the Civil War. She finished his sentences. She marched at the head of the parades. Now, it ticked people off, but Marr, from his Young Ireland days, thought women had full equality. Mm-hmm. I found this beautiful letter he wrote her when he was proposing her hand in marriage. And he says, look, I have no one. I'm a fugitive. I am here alone. I'll never see Ireland again. I haven't seen my family. He had a son from another relationship that was he'd never seen. And he said, but if you will take me, I will share everything with you. I will devote everything. And it was really touching because he rarely spoke in the personal way. And she did do that. She, by the way, her family disowned her for taking up with this Irishman. She lived the rest of her life on a $50 a month Civil War general's pension.
She finishes sentences. I mean, he seems like a guy who,
yeah, they never, you know,
let anyone get a word in edgewise. That tells you a lot.
Good point.
Now, out in the West, he has to face these vigilantes that have grown up to what, prevent people like him or the Irish?
Right. So, and again, I didn't know very much about this. My family's from Montana, and on my mother's side, they're also from his county in Ireland, from County Waterford and from Montana. But this was the largest single episode of vigilante murders, executions in American history. Now, there was a lot of lynching in the South, but this was a protracted single effort that took place over 2 years. Think about this, Marty. We're a constitutional democracy where everyone under this flag has basic rights, a trial, an attorney, you know, of tribal peers. They were grabbing people off the street and stringing them up. And these were the right-thinking citizens. This was the mayor, the merchant, the banker, but they were Freemasons, and they were Protestants. And it's hard to stress how tribal things were, and they were Republicans. And the Irish were Democrats, and they were Catholics, and they were clannish, and they really clashed. This thing, instead of being New Ireland, they just brought their clashes to Montana. So they executed 37 people in the time he was governor, somewhere in that range. And Marr had escaped the noose himself.
And obviously a man who came to this country thinking not just a better life, but there were going to be laws and we were going to be treated
absolutely
as equals. Yeah,
it's the Constitution. He never thought this. He thought he spent all his life blasting the British Empire. How dare they string people up for political passions? Here you were stringing people up without even a trial.
Literally just dragging people off the street. And
well, they would go and have a little meeting. They would have the vigilante meeting. They say, we want to get so-and-so. I mean, one of the people they killed was the sheriff. You know, he was on the wrong side right now. So they grabbed the sheriff in a 20 below zero night, and the sheriff just pled for his life. He's out there screaming, please, please. And they string him up and they say, there is nothing you can say that will change it. The verdict has been set. That was the vigilantes. Again, so here's what happens. I have a picture in the book of one of these unfortunate gentlemen.
Yes.
And we debated whether to put it in. It's kind of gruesome. Yes, there it is. Yeah. Sorry, you can't see this.
Page 284.
But this man was in a card fight, you know, fight over cards, and they decided they were going to kill him. Vigilantes arrest him. Marr pardons him. He's the governor. And he says, you know, he gives him a reprieve and says, now you can appeal to the president for a full pardon because he didn't have that power. That night, they hang him. And in his back pocket is Marr's pardon. And not long after that, they drop a note off in his little cabin. And it's a crudely drawn picture of a noose. And it says, you're next. So that sort of sets the stage for. But, you know, Marr says, get in line. You know, the British Empire is still looking for me. I've had far better men than you come after me. I had you mentioned this. He was twice wounded in the Civil War. He was twice thrown from his horse. This is a man of already a dozen lives. He really doesn't take it seriously.
Well, and there's great mystery about what happened to him. I mean, he died.
Right.
His body was never found.
The people who announced his death were the people who may have killed him. And they said he was a drunk who fell off the ship. And in fact, there's all contemporary accounts that he didn't drink. He did drink, but he didn't drink that day. His stomach was ill. And he was a terrific swimmer, too. This guy, you know, escaped Tasmania through the Bass Strait. He grew up next to the Liffey. He was around water all his life, and that ship was at anchor. Yeah. The account that the Vigilantes gave, which became the official account for almost 100 years, does not hold water. There's pretty good evidence that there was foul play. And in fact, there was – I don't want to give it away. There was a mock trial done in Montana a few years ago with a real judge, a real jury, and real prosecutors, and they concluded that it was a homicide.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. An email from a Thomas Marr. Please ask Mr. Egan if Thomas F. Marr has descendants in the United States or Ireland. I have never found any.
That's a great question.
I'm
in the middle of a book tour, and I'm finding wonderful Marr family members – all over America.
Really?
Everywhere.
Same spelling?
Yes, who are claiming direct ancestry. And I hate to disappoint them, but as near as I could tell, and the Montana Historical Society, because he was their governor, has done a really terrific job of trying to track down the genealogy. Here's what happened. Marr had a son. Never saw him. But after he died, the Civil War widow, his love of his life, raised the boy. So the boy came over from Ireland to America, got into West Point. Eventually had a fairly adventurous life. That child had a son. Uh-huh. That would have been Marr's grandson.
Right.
He died and is buried to this day. You can see the grave, the tombstone, which I did, in a beautiful place in Napa Valley, California. He lives in St. Helena, he's resting in St. Helena, uh-huh, California. And the Montana Historical Society said that was basically the end of the line, that uh-huh, the grandson. But having said that, there are side relatives everywhere. Marr was a very big family with many different spellings from Tipperary in Ireland. So they were descendants of chieftains, and it's a glorious family. So I don't want to diminish the side bits, but the direct lineage seems to have died in California.
You have family. I guess it was your great grandfather that,
yes,
was part of the Irish that went out to Montana.
I was sort of a lapsed Irishman.
Had you made those connections?
No, I'm going to make a confession here. I was sort of a lapsed Irish American. I didn't really know much about my family line, and I didn't know much about the struggles and all the 800 years of memory, which most Irish carry, the memory of oppression and trying to find your way, trying to lead a dignified life, and not only going back to Ireland, to County Waterford, turns out my family is exactly from where Marr's family is from. I mean, the same county. And we found a little town. And godforsaken, my brother said, well, I could see why they left.
Oh, really?
Right.
Kind of down on the hill.
And then they say, oh, yeah, your people are up the hill. Or, yeah, something like that. And then it turns out they were part of the wave of Montana did eventually become, not in Marr's time, Little Ireland or New Ireland. It's got the second highest percentage of Irish Americans per capita of any state in the United States. I mean, people think of Boston and Philly. They don't think of Montana. It's because they came for the mines, and that's what brought my family. So they were raised in a place called Butte, Montana, which is this big copper mine, and it was an Irishman, Daly, who owned the mine, and he hired. So more Gaelic was spoken at one point in Butte, Montana, than any place outside of Ireland.
So do you feel more Irish having written this book then?
I really do sense it, and thank you for the question. it kind of bothers me that as we approach St. Patrick's Day, that it's all about drinking and silly Irish and, you know, this sort of, we call it paddy whackery.
Oh, yes.
You know, and the story is so much richer and deeper, and I really feel that sense of pride. I really do.
Yeah. Let me get Cletus from Bensalem to join our conversation. Cletus, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty, as sure. usual. What a terrific and, of course, timely program.
Yes.
Mr. Egan, I've read some of your stuff in the New York Times when I used to get it to your in Philadelphia. But I wonder if I'm a musician, and I also played a lot of Irish folk songs on guitar and vocals, and I play Irish fiddle for, you know, primarily a lot of dance music. But part of the whole body of Irish music for all my buddies who play it and me, of course, encompasses Irish rebel song. That's the definition of it, basically. And most of them celebrate actual heroes or prisoners who died in prison. Bobby Sands, for instance, back in the mm-hmm. 80s, I guess, early 80s.
Sure.
And in your book, I taught a course at Holy Family University from where I graduated after they hired me. I called the course the History of Irish Music and Dance. And, of course, in that course, sorry for the phrasing there, I covered the rebel songs. And I wonder if you have any, if you mentioned Michael Collins, for instance, who did gain some Irish independence from the hated British back in 1920, 21. I think the 26 counties that make up the south of Ireland are his doing.
Yeah, Cletus, only because we're just about out of time here, I just want to give TV
yeah,
a
well,
chance
it's,
to
and
respond.
Thank you for that, and you're absolutely right. I hope your listeners realize if you are in Ireland, the best thing to do if you see a sign outside of a pub that says Trad Music, T-R-A-D, which is short for traditional music, go in, and that's where you'll hear the history of Ireland. As you just said very brilliantly, that it's stories of martyrs and rebels, and music is a way for a conquered people to show that they had something. Same way as religion. So, they did outlaw the harp for a while, and there's a society of harpists. You look on a bottle of Guinness, what do you see? The harp.
Sure.
What's on the Irish, the brigade flag was a harp. By the way, Mar gave Ireland its flag. That
well,
was another
I
thing.
Saw that as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, I was at an event with the Irish consulate the other night, and they said, well, everyone knows that. I said, no, most people don't know that. Mar gave them the tricolor. So to answer your question, Collins, of course, because of the Easter Rising, which we're celebrating the 100th anniversary of, but Mars people, this is one of the things I loved about the Irish Brigade, and there was some brilliant firsthand stuff. They would play these songs around the campfire, and it kind of ticked off the other generals. Others liked it. But they would stage plays, have steeplechase races, have concerts, play their fiddles till 4 in the morning in between bloody battles. That was one of the things that distinguished the Irish Brigade was poetry and theater and certainly music. And music, as I just said, was a way for a conquered people to show that they hadn't been totally conquered.
And this was a country or a people that the British tried to erase their culture. But,
well,
of course, that's impossible.
I saw the parallel in the way we treated American Indians. My last book was on Edward Curtis, the photographer, and I started to see these parallels because it was a crime for a while to be Indian, to mm-hmm. speak your language, to practice your rituals. They did outlaw some of the Indian culture. Mm-hmm. Similar thing.
And we're almost out of time here. This was a convicted fugitive illegal immigrant
right,
who did all these
right.
things in America.
I don't think he would have been allowed into under one of the current candidates' policies right now.
We're going to end on that note. So, Timothy Egan, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And again, the book is called The Immortal Irishman, The Irish Revolutionary Who Became an American Hero. Timothy Egan is a New York Times op-ed columnist. He's won a number of awards for some of his writing and obviously a guest on Radio Times. For more information about the program, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. I see a lot of comments there, people saying, love this story.
Terrific.
Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.